Today we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday, and we'll be hearing again from the Department of Health, continue on with their budget. And we had scheduled this originally, so that's great. We spent quite a bit of time on one division yesterday, and today we'll try to go through the rest of the budget. You should notice that we have before you from the governor's budget, I believe, is this from the governor's budget? You all have the governor's budget for our committee. The binder, it's unsorted. So all of the accounts that come before this committee are in this budget, so you might want to keep that handy. You can either, when you're done, leave it here and we'll bring it back each time, or if you want to take it back to the office, either way, but it's yours. So it's been sorted so that this is what's within our purview. Just a couple of quick announcements. I'm going to appoint two subcommittees. One will be called Healthy Housing, and the other will be called Environmental Health and Environmental Justice. And I invite you to let me know if you want to be on that committee, either one of them, and I will be announcing the appointments to that next Tuesday. So please let me know if you're interested in that. Some of the issues that we talked about yesterday, for example, might go through some of the Environmental Health subcommittee. Secondly, we are going to be having a tour, homeless shelters and supportive housing tour on Monday, and I hope that many of you can come. If you are planning to come, would you please RSVP to Brooke so that we can make sure we have adequate transportation. We're going to take a bus, I believe, and we'll be treated to information about the legislation that's being proposed on these issues from the advocates who are going to be taking us around. So it should be a very informative shelter. These are all informative tour. The shelters are always very interesting to visit, and we'll get to meet some of the people whose lives we will be impacting by the kinds of legislation that we're passing here.
Madam Chair? Yes. What time on Monday?
I believe we leave at, what time do we leave? 6? Yeah, we leave at 6 outside the state office building, outside the Secretary of State's door. Any other questions about that? Okay. I know we have a number of RSVPs, but please, the rest of you, if you could just let us know. Even let us know if you're not going to be able to come, that would be helpful. All right. Now, we have the minutes from the last meeting, and we'll take the other one. Okay. Had a chance to look at the minutes. If I can have a motion to approve them. Benson? Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes from our last meeting. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Okay. Oh, excuse me. And the minutes from the meeting before. The 17th as well. Representative Benson, did you get a chance to look at those as well?
I'm sorry, I didn't get you.
The minutes from the previous meeting, 17th. I guess there's 2 minutes in here. I'm over the phone. I just need a motion for approval.
I'll move.
I'll move. I'll move. Sorry.
No, that's okay. McFarland. I'm going to let Representative McFarland have that motion because she jumped right in there. So McFarland, Representative McFarland moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Is adopted. Okay. Now we're going to go forward. And the Department of Health, one of the things that I had asked for, and I believe that we're going to have the opportunity to hear about that today, was some information looking backward at the Department of Health's budget back to 2003. We have a lot of new members on this committee, and even those of us who've been around for a while, it's hard to keep track of what's happening with the budget from one biennium to the next. So we had requested this some time ago, and I guess it's now before us. We're going to, I believe, the document is being passed around. So welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health. You should have before you a correctly collated document from the Department of Health on pie charts and funding by division. So thanks to the staff back at the Department of Health who saved me from myself. I'd also like to, before we get started, on behalf of Commissioner Mandernach, invite the committee over to our public health laboratory and our new Freeman building for a tour. She meant to extend that invitation to you all yesterday and forgot. So I'd like to extend that to you today, and we'd be happy to work with you to arrange a time for you to come by and get a tour and see, connect the dots between what you see on paper and what we actually do hands-on.
So. If I could just check with you, are you interested in having us come en masse, or are you inviting
En masse would be perfect, would be fine. Whatever works for the committee, if you want to take a committee slot and do it during a committee time, or arrange for another time that works for all of you, or do it in two groups, whatever works.
We'll work on that. Try to look at a couple options with you, and we can announce that at our next committee meeting. Okay. Thank you.
Since we didn't see these pages yesterday, I just wanted to reference them quickly today. And if you look on page one, again, is an overview of all of our funding sources. And page two is the pie chart that shows where our funding goes. And only 38% of our funding remains at the Department for MDH-based activity, our regulatory activity, our public education, and so forth. And two-thirds almost of our budget goes out in grants, and you can see what our major grant programs are there, most of which we'll talk about today. And then on page three is a pie chart which shows how our funding is allocated among the divisions that we're walking through one by one today, both for your committee. And we spent time yesterday talking about environmental health and the work that they do, so we will move right to page six. Infectious disease epidemiology, prevention, and control. And this division is primarily funded with federal funds. 20% of the budget for this division is from the general fund. And 20% of the budget also goes out the door in grants, and that's both general fund and federal funds that go out the door in grants. With me is Craig Aiken, the Assistant Division Director for Infectious Disease, and he is going to walk you through page 7, explaining the activities of the division.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Aiken.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. As Assistant Commissioner Kelly said, my name is Craig Aiken. I'm the Assistant Director of the Division of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention, and Control for the Minnesota Department of Health. By way of background, excuse me, actually in a little bit of irony, I also have two small children who apparently are infected, excellent vectors for passing contagious disease, so please excuse my coughing this morning. Infectious disease is a broad category, and by way of introduction, I'd just like to give a framework for what that might mean in terms of the activities that our division carries out. Some of the work that we do looks for and investigates surveillance for novel or emerging pathogens, such as might be associated with bioterrorism or perhaps pandemic flu. We also, diseases may come from contaminated food, such as the recent E. coli 0157 outbreak that was in the news. We also look for diseases carried by animals, such as rabies and others, insects, such as Lyme disease or West Nile virus. Some of the diseases that we investigate may be caused by common pathogens that are now gaining new resistance to antibiotics or drugs. And some of these might be recent cases of Staphylococcus aureus. They're now resistant to penicillin-based drugs and are causing new infection control problems in hospitals and clinics. Or that might include tuberculosis cases that are becoming resistant to all of the different tuberculosis treatment drugs that we have and is a growing health threat concern both internationally and here in Minnesota. Finally, some of the diseases that we work with are preventable now by vaccines, fortunately. Polio, measles, mumps are examples. And some are becoming a part of our society, like HIV. And we work with all of these different diseases, working to understand them, prevent them, control them, and in general, protect the public's health in terms of infectious disease outbreaks and contagion. We employ about 170 staff in our division. As was mentioned, we have about 75% of our funding is federal funding. 25% coming from the state. I'd like to walk through our programs quickly. My goal today is to be more brief than my colleague, Director Stein, was yesterday. So I think I have an easy mark to hit. And so I'm just going to walk through page 7 very quickly and talk a little bit about our program activities. We have three sections in our division. The first is immunization, tuberculosis, and international health. In that, we do basically a number of activities. We manage the immunization program for the state of Minnesota, which includes the Vaccines for Children program, making sure that all children have availability of free federal vaccines if they're unable to get those. We maintain an immunization registry, which is an electronic database to ensure that those immunization records follow individuals no matter where they might go, through schools, clinics, hospitals. We also maintain immunization practices improvement, where we make sure that these vaccine programs are being administered properly, including proper handlings and storage and administration of vaccines. In that group is also our International Refugee Health Program, which is some of the state money is used for. In essence, all refugees that come through Minnesota, the goal is to screen them for health concerns and disease before they enter the general population to make sure that they can receive the proper case management and treatment. In Minnesota in 2005, there were approximately more than 5,000 refugees that came here. It's a growing segment of our population here in Minnesota. A large number of them come here with diseases which may become potential health threats. Our goal is to try to catch that and make sure that they receive the proper treatment. That demographic is changing. It has moved from what was largely Southeast Asian immigrants to now sub-Saharan African immigrants. And so the diseases that they bring with them are changing as well, and we've been adapting to that. Finally, in that immunization, TB, and international health program is our tuberculosis program. Tuberculosis is a growing concern. In Minnesota, in last year, we had over 200 cases of active TB infection. We make sure that people have proper case management by providing grants to local public health to follow up and make sure those people are given proper drugs and medications. And we also pay for the testing and medications for those individuals. And that's where some of this money goes for the TB grants. 17% of our cases last year in Minnesota of tuberculosis were multi-drug resistant. In essence, there's about 13 drugs that we use to treat tuberculosis. Four of them are what we call our initial frontline drugs. Multi-drug resistant tuberculosis means that it's a strain of TB that is resistant to at least two of those first four frontline drugs. Last year, we also had a case of extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis, which is becoming a growing international health threat. And in that case, we had an individual here in Minnesota who was resistant to 11 of 13 available drugs to treat the disease. This is certainly a growing concern, and it's something that we're trying to maintain and stay on top of so it doesn't become a larger threat to the general population. Moving along, the acute disease investigation section, we run a number of programs through that. We maintain a bioterrorism epidemiology surveillance unit, which monitors actively and works with local law enforcement to ensure that unexpected and novel and diseases that might be threats or used for terrorism are caught early and shared with local law enforcement. We work cooperatively with Homeland Security on that program. We also maintain a 24-hour on-call system and hotline for healthcare clinics and providers to seek our advice and assistance should they come across something at any time of the day that they have questions about. And we work closely with our public health laboratory to isolate those diseases. We also have a foodborne, vector-borne, and zoonotic disease unit. That unit works to investigate outbreaks of foodborne diseases, particularly in restaurants, and most notably the case with the Taco John's incident that was in the news recently. We work cooperatively with a number of partners inside the Department of Health and externally, Environmental Health, with Director Stein yesterday. His team is critical to that effort, as well as the Department of Agriculture and other players. This last year, we actually had a record number of outbreaks of foodborne disease. We went from 40 in 2005 to 90 in 2006. We're seeing this as a growing concern, and we're stepping up our efforts to try to contain that. We also maintain a foodborne hotline where people can call in and provide us with that information so that we can be more prompt and quick in following up in investigations. Vector-borne diseases are diseases carried by insects, such as mosquitoes and ticks. And zoonotic diseases are diseases carried by animals, such as rabies. We also have an emerging infections unit. This tracks invasive bacterial infections, unexplained deaths, other critical illnesses that aren't covered by our other units. We have a required reportable disease rule. There were approximately 90 diseases that, if they show up anywhere, doctors and clinicians are required to report those to us, and so we maintain tracking and surveillance on all those diseases. And then finally, in this unit, we have an infection control and antibiotic resistance unit. That unit works primarily with clinics to help control infections in hospital and clinic settings, but we also provide educational materials for schools, daycares, other settings around hand washing, covering your cough, using proper personal protective equipment, that sort of thing. And some of the money identified in the budget here is used for staffing for that. Our final section is our...
I just have a question on that. In terms of the antibiotic resistance, can you at some point elaborate a little bit on what your educational program is to deal with antibiotic resistance? You can either do it now or a little bit later, but I would like you to talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Madam Chair, if it's all right, maybe I'll do that at the end of this presentation.
All right. Thank you.
But thank you for that question. Finally, our STD and HIV section unit is primarily focusing on two efforts. Sexually transmitted diseases is a category of diseases that includes approximately 25 different transmitted infections. These are things certainly like syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, others that we maintain surveillance on and work with to try to prevent. And also then, obviously, the most significant sexually transmitted disease is HIV, which can become AIDS. And we work with a number of community partners to work with the affected populations that are particularly carrying a disproportionate burden of this disease. And so these are largely underserved minority groups, and we work with local partnerships and community organizations to reach out and connect with them to make sure that they receive the testing and treatment that they need. Finally, our pandemic influenza planning, we did receive some one-time money for epidemiology, which was largely to increase our outstate capacity and support to local public health around epidemiology. And our public education campaign is an effort to promote an educational campaign for personal and family emergency planning preparedness, which in the event of a pandemic flu or any other public health emergency allows people to know what to do, to have a plan in place, and to be ready for a situation that might occur. And then finally, the director's office, that money is used to provide direction and support for this division's activities. So,
thank you. Any questions from committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So would you explain to me the under the STD and HIV section, section management, it seems that there is a decrease for this biennium, and is there something that's driving that decrease in the budget in that area? Or am I reading that wrong?
Jake.
Madam Chair, Representative, it does appear that there's a slight decrease. Largely, our HIV and STD programs are funded by large Centers for Disease Control and Prevention federal grants. This money is used to augment that in terms of providing state administration and match dollars for those programs. In this case, there is some fluidity around how we pay for those staff, either from the state dollars or the federal dollars, and I would have to look at this precisely.
Madam Chair and Representative, one of the things we did in the current fiscal year is to reallocate some of our general fund resources that we, from the previous fiscal year that had been unspent because of salary savings, we reallocated some of those resources for translation purposes. And so some of the general fund dollars that were from other areas of the department were put in this area to improve their ability to translate their programmatic materials to meet their target population needs. And so we put additional resources in the current fiscal year that are not a part of the base budget going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just ask a question, just a little bit of a follow-up to that? Looking on the budget history that you have, the governor's recommendations, I'm trying to locate that item. Is that on there?
On page 2 is the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division, their general fund history. Did you want me to speak to that?
Well, yeah, I think in terms of what Representative Morgan was asking about, the where are we with the governor's recommendation on that?
The governor's recommendation, the last two columns, the governor is recommending additional funding in this area for tuberculosis prevention and testing and treatment.
Kelly, how about the HIV/AIDS? I think that was the question.
The governor's recommending that the base continue for HIV/AIDS. No change to that particular funding line.
Right. Everything's well. I have a question about the pandemic and influenza planning section. Can you tell me why there is zero at base for both 08 and 09?
Madam Chair, Representative Swales. The money was appropriated last biennium as a one-time appropriation. Okay. The governor has asked for additional funding for this in his budget. And Assistant Commissioner Kelly might go off in more detail.
The governor is recommending additional funding for PanFlu to continue some of the efforts we started this current fiscal year. You'll actually see the amount on page 3 of the three-page handout of our history. The last two columns have the governor's recommendation, and it's under the Office of Emergency Preparedness. The request is all centralized there, so you can see what it all is, that it actually will be spent in multiple divisions throughout the department, this particular amount here. So some of what had been funded in fiscal year 07 with the one-time money will be continued with the governor's recommendation, specifically the epidemiology. The governor's recommendation does not include continued funding for public education campaigns.
Right. Thank you, Madam. Could you... Could you say again, the governor's budget does not include funding for continued public education? Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, the governor's recommendation for pandemic influenza preparedness does not include in it funding for a public education campaign. That was a one-time activity. His recommendation for pandemic influenza preparedness includes antivirals, supplies, MDH staff in the areas of the public health lab, epidemiology, infection control, and grants to locals. And
okay, thank you. What is that, Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of more of a global question, I think, but this is, I mean, this whole issue of infectious diseases, you know, when we hear about resistant antibiotic diseases that are occurring, and we hear about the pandemic stuff, and we hear about all of this. Just from the perspective of the department, is there one or two things that you see as being kind of the most significant issues that we should be addressing kind of in our in this arena as we look to the future?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. I would first of all say that it's always important, but of course I'm a little biased. So, but in essence, I think that there's two activities that the governor's budget supports that I do think are critical issues. One of those is that preparing for a potential pandemic flu, which is a significant potential health risk. We have past examples of pandemic flu outbreaks globally to draw experience off of as to what that might mean. H5N1 influenza, which is the current threat in Southeast Asia, being carried by birds and fowl, appears to be very similar in nature, potentially, to an outbreak of influenza that occurred in 1918, otherwise known as the Spanish flu. In that case, there was significant cause for worry with large-scale illnesses and deaths. And it's not to say that that would happen again, but to be prepared for that, I think, is a critical capacity issue that we, as state servants, need to be thoughtful in preparing for. And the governor puts forward an initiative to fund some activities in that arena. I think the other issue is tuberculosis is certainly an important health threat. And the key to ensuring that tuberculosis resistance to drugs does not continue to increase in Minnesota is one where we need to make sure that we have available drugs and we have available testing, but another key to that is also to have what we call case management. And that's making sure that someone is following up on people who have this disease and they complete their treatment regimen, sometimes requiring something called direct observed therapy, where we actually watch them take their drugs and finish the course. If they start and they don't complete, those are the situations that can lead to a drug-resistant form of the disease, which is a greater health threat and certainly a greater cost. A typical case of tuberculosis in terms of medication can cost maybe $800 to treat. A drug-resistant case can cost up to $25,000. So there's a significant avenue for prevention here that I think that by taking advantage of, we can do some real good.
Representative Madore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. In particular, in Dakota County, I'm sure you're aware, I'm getting back to STD and HIV. We've had a significant increase in the amounts of chlamydia against our younger population. And what I'm understanding from my public health director in Dakota County is that they have limited resources from your department to help do public education on that. But then additionally, they're also fearful about the HIV line being taken down this year. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. Is that accurate? And if it is, what initiative was that following, given our numbers of HIV also increasing? And having an access line that's confidential, I think, would be a number one priority for your department for people to get information.
Jay.
Madam Chair, Representative, those are excellent questions. Chlamydia is certainly a growing sexually transmitted disease concern here in Minnesota, and it is one of many sexually transmitted diseases that we need to be thoughtful about how we approach with the resources that we have. I think that we have a program in place where we're actually doing additional research around chlamydia and its infection and the demographics that are being affected by that disease. It's our hope to continue to do more with the resources that we have. As for the HIV hotline, that was an operation that was funded by an outside partner, or that was run by an outside partner with funds that came from the Department of Health. Unfortunately, we've had federal budget rescissions, and frankly, that have forced us to, we were unable to continue to fund that operation, unfortunately.
Bella?
I'm just a bit boggled by that. I don't understand, was there an evaluation on the amount of calls coming in? I mean, was there a discussion that centered around the service being provided, or was it just cut because it was a small dollar amount to cut? I'm confused as to why a hotline would be cut.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have that answer, so I apologize. But you?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, we did do some surveying of our partners in terms of here are all the activities we do around STDs and HIV and help us prioritize which are most important, which are most critical. And the hotline actually came up on the bottom of the priority list. Knowing that we had federal rescissions coming, we went out and worked with our partners to help identify what the greatest priority. There are other hotlines that were available to folks that were not Minnesota-specific, but that were more national-based. And maintaining our grants, going out to community-based organizations, maintaining our outreach efforts, was a higher priority than maintaining the hotline. And with the federal rescission and our limited general fund resources, we couldn't do everything.
Ms. Amador?
I guess I need to think about that for a minute, because I'm wondering what the analysis was. Was it, is it a language barrier? Is it an issue that that there wasn't enough? From what I'm understanding from my public health director is that there used to be brochures and posters and things like that available, that number was highlighted. That was cut probably 4 years ago, and the hotline was the last thing that was left, and it was a confidential way for people to get information, and now that's gone. So I'm wondering, was it cut because it started to be cut 4 years ago, and then it was just cut last year because of these other funding priorities? What was the analysis done to determine the effectiveness? And the reason I ask is just because of the amount of increases that I'm seeing in these populations, a confidential free line that's staffed with somebody that can give real appropriate information to the people that need it, I think is vitally important in a job that you should be doing. So I want to support you in getting more funding for that if that's what we're looking at here. I don't.
Madam Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to provide you the specifics. I don't have it with me, and I don't have a recall in terms of what specifically we did do to work to determine. But don't misunderstand me that it's not a priority at all. I mean,
right. It
is a priority. It's just with limited resources, it wasn't something within the constraints of federal but reductions that we could continue to do. But we'll get that analysis to you.
Representative,
could I ask in the future if we could have a little more overview of this, perhaps, and what other services and public education around STD and HIV and AIDS.
It's an excellent idea. Maybe if you could take that back to the department at another time, maybe we could schedule a more comprehensive hearing. And I think one of the important issues I would add to that is some of the disparities in terms of populations, communities of color, low-income people, if we could add that to what we would be discussing there. And I do want to mention, Representative Maduro, this agency's budget is going to be on our table, and you're going to have a chance to impact it. So you certainly think about what you might be interested in there.
Thank you.
Representative
Cram. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I was trying to think about, do I have a question or a comment? I'm just going to think out loud. And a lot of it was spurred by Representative Eastland's question. I think when we look through a lot of this stuff, it's all important. But I'm almost trying to make it simple. So I'm going to plea on the side of simplicity here and just ask if there's a top 10 list or something that we should be focusing on. And I guess I'm thinking of it in terms of the budget as well. If we could go back maybe two bienniums and give us a history of funding, and you can just do it in general categories. But I'm curious, based on where we were and where we are now and even the projection of where we might be, what are those increases and decreases by category, and what do they do? So I guess my question is it possible to somehow break this down by category and say, here's where we were last year financially, here's where we anticipate, here's what we see in the future, and then for each of those categories say, an increase in this area will help us provide X, or a decrease in this area will make us have to cut X. And so then that way we can, going through all these numbers and it's a combination of the federal budget and the state budget and grants and where all this stuff goes, I'm just looking for a more simple form that I can look at and go, boy, if we need to help in this area, we need to put money here, or this cut got happened there, and how do we, I guess, does that make any sense?
Ms. Kelly?
Madam Chair and Representative Krantz, We tried to accomplish that with this three-page handout that shows the history, and we really, in recent years, haven't made a lot of changes to funding in this area. We've done some grant consolidation around health disparities, tuberculosis, grants that we had going out to communities. We took those funds and put them into a larger block grant to give local units of government more flexibility in their spending. When we consolidated all the grants, there was a reduction back in 2004, 2005, and that may be some of what Dakota County Public Health is referencing. Other than that, we've just done some minor adjustments. Obviously, there are pressures from year to year as the cost of doing business increases each year, and we've had to make adjustments internally, but we haven't made any major changes to this program. And what we think are the big things to focus on, as Craig Akam mentioned, is TB prevention and pandemic influenza preparedness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. Maybe it's early right now, and we're only in the budget digesting period of this, but maybe it's just a comment for the future that I think it would help us out a lot in trying to figure out, well, what does a 0.1% cut mean in real terms? And I think it speaks to the transparency that the public is looking for as well. So I think the more that we can kind of keep those in mind as we're moving forward, if we can increase resources in this area, it will help us provide whatever it is, and then consequently what the decrease is as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to work with your fiscal analyst to see if there's more information we can provide.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Akin, I was listening to your testimony. You were mentioning that the Department of Health watches over, regulates the handling of vaccines and so. Does the Department of Health also regulate or watch over the content of vaccines? For example, there's been a lot of discussion about the use of certain compounds, mercury compounds in vaccines. Some groups are concerned, or some have mentioned maybe a possible connection with that and the increase in dyslexia or other kinds of childhood maladies. Is the Department of Health regulating or watching over that?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, just to clarify, the Department of Health doesn't regulate vaccines.
Right.
What we provide is guidance to clinics, public health providers, on how they should store vaccines, how they should administer vaccines, how they should handle vaccines. But the actual content of the vaccines is managed at a different level. The issue that you alluded to with mercury-based compounds in some vaccines is referred to as thimerosal.
Okay.
And thimerosal has been a debated issue, whether its purpose is to act as a preservative, but it does contain a small amount of mercury. And there have been a number of studies to show what the health impacts of that might be. And the current research doesn't suggest that it's linked to some of the, like, autism or those kinds of issues that you were referring to.
Mental.
However, it's not to say that people don't have discomfort with mercury and vaccines. And I would say that in general, thimerosal's use as a preservative in vaccines is diminishing. Generally, in most childhood-required vaccinations, it isn't used anymore. It is used, however, in some influenza vaccinations and some other vaccinations, and that's an issue that's being debated.
What would be an agency, state agency, that might be related to that or to monitor that kind of product?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I'm not sure that there's a state agency that does that. I believe it's at the federal level, but I can check on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Benson, Representative Benson, just want to indicate, though, again, you're at the table here, and one of the things that we can talk about in this committee is public health tracking, I would call it. There are certain kinds of things that we could be asking our state agencies to be looking at. This particular area is a pretty controversial one. I think it's interesting to note that the thimerosal is decreasing, probably in response to public demand. And I think it would be interesting to know what the issues of access are here, because if I'm correct, let me know. I believe that thimerosal in vaccines, there are vaccines that are available without it, as you mentioned, more and more, for especially for young children, but even for adults, but you have to know that you can ask for them. Mm-hmm. And you probably have to pay more. And I'm just wondering, maybe you could do you have some information on that? And hasn't the health department weighed in on this discussion in the past when there have been bills dealing with this?
Madam Chair, you are correct. And you'll have to forgive some of the questions that I've been asked today. I'm new to the department, and so Okay. Some of the history I'm unfamiliar with, and so please forgive my ignorance in that regard. In terms of how this has been debated in the past, I don't know if Assistant Commissioner Kelly might be able to offer some insight.
Commissioner Kelly.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I think the best thing would be for someone to come back, but just in a nutshell, we have, I think there have been changes made in vaccines over time, that the amount of vaccines out there that are thimerosal-free are increasing every year. There has been bills before this committee and before in both Senate and House requiring the department to purchase or requiring the state to use only thimerosal-free vaccines. For a variety of reasons, we have not supported those bills. One reason is cost, that they are significantly more expensive and fewer people would have access to vaccines. Another reason is that the supply is not adequate to meet the demand, the supply of thimerosal-free vaccines. And I think there were a number of other reasons, but I think that there has been significant progress made in recent years. And Chris Erisman, our director in that area, would probably be best able to speak more eloquently on the subject.
I'm sorry, who did you say would be?
Christine Erisman.
Okay, she happened to be here.
We can...
Okay. And we can have some more discussion on that. That's a
topic. Chair, may I ask that we invite that individual here at some time that be appropriate for your schedule?
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley?
Just a comment on that. There's always bills to outlaw vaccines that have thimerosal in it. The reason thimerosal is in some vaccines, is particularly those that come in multi-dose vials, where you're sticking needle after needle in there. If you have single-dose vial, then it usually does not have thimerosal. But those are much more expensive. And vast majority of scientific evidence, all the way from the Institute of Medicine in Washington down to the FDA and all the medical societies, including pediatrics, agree that there is no connection between thimerosal and autism. There are some scientists that think that there is, but the vast majority of the scientific evidence in this country and scientists that study these issues believe there's no connection between autism and mercury.
We'll leave it at that. It's a controversial issue. We can have some more discussion on that in the future, and we'll ask some of the experts to come in.
Madam Chair,
okay.
Just not to forget your previous question about institutional infection control and antibiotic resistance, perhaps in the interest of time, I could just send you some more detailed information in regards to that.
Okay, well, it is a really big area of concern, the increasing resistance to antibiotics. And one of the things I'd ask you to do in terms of any data you might have is looking at educational programs around the kinds of soaps and so on that are out there that are supposedly related to, in some research, to increasing the resistance of the population to antibiotics. So if you could, I don't know if you've been looking at that. The Girl Scouts did in Minnesota. They did a really nice research project on this a few years ago and testified, I believe, in the Senate about the impact of using so-called antibacterial soaps, what that's doing to antibiotic resistance. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's quite interesting information.
Madam Chair, I am. Largely our work, though, is working with healthcare institutions on kind of institutional infection control regarding antibiotic resistance, and rather than a public campaign like maybe what you just described. So just so you're aware of the gist of our focus. And that program is largely funded with federal funds from the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention, which we don't have a lot of latitude in terms of how we direct those efforts. So, and that's the focus of that program.
Thank you. Do you want to move on to the next?
Yes, Madam Chair, I think we will move on to our public health laboratory, which is begins on page 8 of your handout. Our public health laboratory is funded with a combination of federal funds, general funds, fee revenues, and contracts that we have with divisions within the department, other state agencies, and other non-state entities. The funding is 100% stays within the laboratory. There are no grants that go out. And on page 9, Chris Everson, who is our acting director of the public health laboratory, will walk us through the details.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Everson.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Chris Everson. I'm the acting director of the public health laboratory division. The activities of the public health laboratory are based in science and service. Our scientists analyze a wide variety of samples and specimens that may contain infectious agents, hazardous chemicals, or radioactive materials. Our laboratory is well regarded nationally because of our scientific capability, quality of our work, and our partnerships with public, private, and program partners. Our core laboratory activities, funded by general fund dollars, include monitoring for public health threats, detecting common, rare, and emerging health threats, identifying rare chemical, radiological, and biological hazards, and preparing and responding to chemical, radiological, and biological emergencies. Our core activities funded through fee revenues are screening babies born in Minnesota for rare, life-threatening congenital and heritable disorders. And we certify all environmental laboratories that conduct environmental testing for Minnesota regulatory programs. Our laboratory is organized into three sections. Our environmental laboratory, which focuses on environmental sample analysis. Our clinical laboratory, whose focus is human and biological samples. Our laboratory services section, which provides the needed technical support for our laboratories to function. And finally, division management, which provides overall management for the division budget, finance, policy, strategic planning, and compliance with regulations that govern the operations of laboratories. I'd like to just briefly talk first about our environmental laboratory. Our general fund supports emergency preparedness and response activities. Our environmental laboratory participates as a member of Minnesota's radiological response team and maintains preparedness to receive and analyze radiological samples 24/7. We support environmental monitoring near Minnesota's nuclear power plants. We analyze environmental samples such as soil, milk, water, vegetation, all collected from the areas surrounding the nuclear power plants. We respond to public health threats from chemical or radiological exposures by providing 24/7 analytical capability and scientific expertise. We respond to environmental emergencies, including environmental accidents, natural and man-made disasters, including suspected terrorism events. Our environmental laboratory participates in the National Laboratory Response Network. Over 62 state, territorial, and metropolitan public health laboratories are members of this network. In fact, our environmental laboratory is one of 10 laboratories designated by the National Laboratory Response Network as a Level 1 laboratory. A Level 1 laboratory has the capability to detect not only toxic chemical agents, but also has the capability to detect an expanded number of chemicals, including mustard agents, nerve agents, and other toxic industrial chemicals. Our environmental laboratory scientists work closely with local public health, the State Patrol, Minnesota Department of Homeland Security, first responders, the National Guard, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, FBI, and others to maintain preparedness. Our environmental laboratory also, via contractual arrangements, performs approximately 76,000 tests each year to detect chemical, radiological, and bacterial contaminants in water, soil, and air. Next, I'd like to just briefly review the activities of our clinical laboratory. Our clinical lab analyzes approximately 56,000 clinical specimens per year for infectious bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites. Our clinical laboratory has four major responsibilities. The first is monitoring for public health threats. We conduct statewide monitoring to detect public health threats posed by newly identified infectious agents. For example, we continuously monitor circulating influenza strains, and we are a collaborating laboratory for influenza surveillance for the CDC in connection with the World Health Organization. We are always looking for major changes in the virus that might signal a pandemic strain. We conduct susceptibility testing to detect trends in drug resistance. This is important because our findings can impact policy and patient treatment decisions. We collaborate with the Minnesota Department of Health Acute Disease Epidemiology Programs to identify trends such as the emergence of new diseases, as well as the re-emergence of serious diseases such as tuberculosis. For example, we conduct diagnostic testing for TB and perform drug susceptibility testing on isolates from all TB cases in Minnesota. This is significant because this information is used by healthcare providers to guide treatment decisions, and it provides information to prevention and control programs to guide their program activities. The second major responsibility of our clinical lab is disease outbreak investigation and control. Our clinical lab analyzes human specimens to monitor, identify, and respond to potential disease outbreaks. And through the analysis of human specimens, the laboratory and acute disease epidemiology programs can detect a disease outbreak, focus a disease outbreak investigation, and plan an effective public health intervention. For example, in the recent Taco John's outbreak, our laboratory analyzed specimens and were able to provide data to link cases both in Minnesota and outside of Minnesota using DNA fingerprinting. The third major responsibility of our clinical lab is reference testing. Our clinical lab provides reference and confirmatory testing of specimens in collaboration with hospitals, clinics, and other clinical labs in the state. Isolates of bacteria or viruses believed to be important are sent to us for definitive identification. This service is provided because our laboratory staff have expertise not always available in most clinical labs. There are many benefits to this partnership. It effectively extends and increases the testing capability of Minnesota hospitals, clinics, and clinical laboratories. It allows our staff to maintain the skills needed to identify new situations that invariably come up in the field of infectious disease. It is this activity that would likely discover a pandemic strain of influenza or unrecognized smallpox. And this activity also serves as a referral center for specimens sent to the CDC for further testing. The final area of responsibility for our clinical lab is emergency preparedness and response. We maintain preparedness to respond 24/7 to disease outbreaks, terrorism threats, and rare disease testing. Our clinical lab is also a member of the National Laboratory Response Network. We receive samples from hospital emergency rooms, clinics, schools, mailing facilities, first responders, and local, state, and national law enforcement agencies. We also, in the clinical lab, work with local public health, the State Patrol, Department of Homeland Security, National Guard, CDC, and FBI, and others to maintain our preparedness. Another important feature of our emergency preparedness and response activities is a statewide voluntary network of laboratories called the Minnesota Laboratory System. The system is used to facilitate interlaboratory communications, collaboration, and cooperation. It's based on electronic connectivity as an essential tool, and this ensures prompt communication, which is critical in the event of an emergency. I'd like to talk about our fee-supported programs now, the first being our newborn screening program.
Maybe before we get to that, you're going into a new division there? Are you still saying it with the the Office of Emergency Preparedness.
The I'm just separating out the general fund activities with the state government special.
I have a couple questions, and if I could, for just a moment, I want to interrupt you because I'd like to introduce the 9th to 12th grade students who are here from the Minnesota Internship Center. You want to stand up? Welcome to the committee. Mm-hmm. 9th to 12th graders. How many of you are 12th graders? Okay. Great to see you. Welcome. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
The Public Health Laboratory screens all newborns in Minnesota shortly after birth for 53 rare heritable and congenital medical conditions. Each year, our newborn screening program screens approximately 72,000 infants born in Minnesota and saves the lives or greatly improves the quality of life for approximately 100 of those children. The program is funded by a fee which is assessed to the hospital for each newborn screen. This covers the cost of both newborn screening and short-term follow-up activities. The system includes birthing hospitals, nursery staff, laboratory scientists, couriers, specialists, pediatricians, primary care providers, geneticists, and staff who connect family with the needed resources. Birthing hospitals collect blood spots from the newborns and submit the specimens to the newborn screening program via courier or UPS. If our screening shows an abnormal result, our genetic counselors immediately phone and fax the baby's physician, and phone calls are made by genetic counselors and clinicians to specialists who are familiar with these rare disorders. In 2006, our newborn screening program began screening newborns for cystic fibrosis. CF is a genetic disease that most commonly affects breathing and digestion. While this disease is incurable, advances in CF treatment continue to have a great impact on the length and quality of life for babies with CF. The success of our newborn screening program in Minnesota is largely a result of our public-private partnerships. We partner with the University of Minnesota to assure that babies are immediately connected with specialty care. We partner with the Mayo Clinic's Biochemical Genetics Laboratory to screen newborns using advanced technology called tandem mass spectrometry, also known as TMS. TMS makes it possible to screen for multiple conditions using a single test. Mayo Clinic's Biochemical Genetics Laboratory screens for 42 disorders, and our department screens for 11. Our program partnerships are also critical to assure families receive appropriate treatment before the onset of symptoms. We partner with the department's Family Health Division, who works closely with families to assure that affected babies are immediately connected with the specialty care and needed resources. This is very important because treatment may require multiple services and are often provided by a patchwork of agencies, both public and private, and some resources may not be available locally for the management of these rare disorders. The next program that we have supported by fees is the Environmental Laboratory Certification Program. This program certifies approximately 170 private and public environmental laboratories to perform testing for federal programs that require laboratory certification. This program is also entirely supported by fees who are paid by the laboratories who request certification. It is a voluntary certification program. In Minnesota, these federal programs are administered by the Environmental Health Division of the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Our final fee program is called the Laboratory Specimen Handling Fee. It's a small fee assessed to specimens, and it pays for a small amount of our specimen sample receiving costs. Finally, I'd like to talk about our laboratory services section. This section provides technical support to ensure the effective operations of the clinical environmental laboratories. The activities funded in part by general fund include information technology management. We develop and maintain our laboratory information management system to track, record, and promptly report laboratory analytical results. We are continuously working to improve our electronic data exchange capabilities. For example, we are collaborating with the Centers for Disease Control and six other states to advance the Public Health Laboratory Interoperability Project, which will create capacity to exchange pandemic influenza testing results electronically. Our laboratory support section provides technical support services, including specimen sample receiving, sample and reagent preparation, purchasing of supplies, preparation delivery of material needed for testing, decontamination of infectious material, management of hazardous waste, and our safety program. Finally, division management, as I mentioned earlier, provides support to division-wide activities such as budget development, workforce planning, policy development, strategic planning, contract management, etc. Finally, I would like to make you aware that in November of 2005, we moved into a new laboratory building here on the Capitol complex, and we are very grateful to the legislature for authorizing the funding to build this state-of-the-art facility. I'd just like to echo the comments by Commissioner Kelly that we'd love to have you come and visit us, and we'd love to provide you a tour of Minnesota's new facility. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you a question. As I was looking at the document for the public health laboratories, it looks like the environmental lab, if I'm reading this correctly, has the base for this year is reduced by about $500,000. Am I reading that properly?
Madam Chair, again, we made some reallocations of general fund dollars in fiscal years 06 and 07 to address some of the operating costs in our public health lab. And it's not that we've reduced the budget, but that we've actually increased the budget in 06 and 07. And we did that at the expense of other divisions in the department. One of the things we have learned in our new building is that it's much more expensive to operate our new laboratory compared to our old laboratory. And the governor's budget includes increased funding for our public health laboratory to address some of these operating costs.
Could you just address that a little bit more? I'm wondering, it is correct then that we've reduced the general fund appropriation to that, and does that mean that the important bottom line is, I guess, is there going to be less service to the public? And one of the issues here, of course, is the public's access to tests. And we had a discussion yesterday about, you know, the fluorochemicals and the concern of the public about that. But everything, in my particular community, we have a big problem with arsenic and on the ground from a pesticide that was laid down there over the last 50 years or so. Community is having a very difficult time getting tests for arsenic. So, and that would come under, I believe, the environmental lab if they were to try to ask the state of Minnesota to help with this, because many physicians don't do that type of testing in their clinics. Have we actually reduced the capability of the state to help with those kinds of tests? And if so, are the fees going up, or what is the governor's budget change it?
Madam Chair, with the governor's budget, funding for the lab will be maintained in fiscal years 08-09 as it is in 06 and 07. And we'll be able to maintain capacity that we currently have.
So even, Ms. Kelly, even though it shows a reduction here?
Madam Chair, this is base funding. And our base funding for the laboratory has been level in 06, 07, 08, 09. We made some internal reallocations in fiscal years 06 and 07 as we had salary savings. As we hire 200 people a year at the Department of Health. We don't add 200 people to our staff, but people leave. And oddly enough, they find better jobs elsewhere or they retire. And so it takes us time to refill those positions, and we budget to have a position filled for 100% of the year. And so if a position is vacant for a month, we take those resources and put them where we have a need for additional funding. And so we have taken dollars in the current biennium that were not a part of the laboratory space and added to the laboratory space because the cost of operating the lab is higher than we anticipated. Without additional resources in our budget in the next biennium, we would not be able to maintain services in the lab, but the governor's budget does include increased funding You won't see that on page 9 because this only reflects base funding. You'll see that on page 3 of the three-page handout with the history.
Mm-hmm.
The governor's recommending almost $500,000 for a public health laboratory.
Okay, and I noticed that there, and can you tell me how that will impact the public costs? In other words, a family who wants to have the Minnesota Department of Health help them understand what their exposure is to a particular toxin. What's the bottom line here in terms of any access costs? Or physician bringing that.
Madam Chair, our laboratory works primarily with program partners. We work with PCA. We work with the Environmental Health Division. What this does is provide us the capacity to develop those types of analyses, and we would work with our program partners to meet the needs of the public.
Okay. My question continues, though. What is the impact on the cost to the public?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I quite follow. If you're asking if we're going to be doing additional testing that we otherwise would have charged for, is that what you're asking?
Well, let's just say the folks that we were talking about yesterday with the fluorochemicals, you know, some of the people in those communities, Cottage Grove, Oakdale, they are going to get tested. Okay, and they're bearing the cost themselves privately, from what I understand. Same thing's happening, you know, around the state with all different kinds of issues. I know there used to be a service at the Minnesota Department of Health where individuals could get that kind of testing paid for by our public agencies. So my question is that still available? And if it is, has the cost gone up, or will it go up as a result of having this new lab, or budget cuts, or will the governor's additional supplement here help reduce that, or does it have no impact?
Madam Chair, our laboratory, I think, had provided that kind of service in the future, but I think has not done that for at least 10 years, maybe more, provided testing services to individual members of the public.
Okay, and that includes physicians, laboratories, and so on? Okay. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Everson, you mentioned environmental lab and taking over 76,000 tests each year, and you specifically mentioned nuclear plant samples, and I have a nuclear facility in my district. But I also have a coal-fired plant in my district, too, and I'm just wondering, do you test for those type of plants as far as toxicity or things that are in the ground environmentally wise?
Madam Chair, no, we do not.
No. Okay. Just why do you single out nuclear versus the coal fire? Because I hear a lot of conversation regarding coal fired plants being a big concern to the environment.
Madam Chair, Representative. We, again, work in collaboration with other program partners. So we work with the Environmental Health Division, and we work with the Department of Homeland Security in terms of meeting our responsibilities for the environmental monitoring in the areas around the nuclear power plants. That has, I think we'd need to talk with maybe Environmental Health or the Minnesota Pollution, probably the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, about that type of monitoring. That would be more of their responsibility and area of expertise.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we'll get back to you as to whether that's under the purview of our environmental health area or pollution control.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson, I just want to join you in your question, because it is a part of the community's right to know what's going on in their community, and actually we will be looking at some legislation in that, because it's a very complex answer to your question, from what I can tell. Really difficult to figure out who's responsible for what, and it goes through about 3 or 4 different agencies, including your own local, and even gets over the Department of Public Safety. It's very complex.
Well, Madam Chair, it's interesting that we've got 3 or 4 different people monitoring one plant when we're kind of duplicating the efforts of bringing, if someone could do this, the test for all two, three plants at one time. So they're bringing out three different agencies at three different locations. I mean, to me, it looks like it could be a way to reduce costs.
Okay, let's put that together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Ms. Everson?
Everson,
thank you. I want to maybe get back to the Chair's questions on the environmental lab. First of all, I'm a scientist by background myself. I think it's eminently important for us to have good public health laboratory research facilities, particularly when it comes to issues like we heard testimony on yesterday. I think Representative Bunn did a very good job of expressing the concerns of her constituents from her background about that. So I just want to, and I appreciate, Commissioner Kelly, your comment that there is no decrease in capacity, but as I see it, it's a matter of the number of scientists available to do the work, or improvements in technology that can allow fewer scientists to do the same work or even more work that was done before. So let me try to be a little more pointed in my question. Is the proposed budget for the next biennium, will the same number of FTE, if you will, of researchers be available in the environmental lab area as before, or will there be a decrease? And if there is a decrease, is that because there is that added technology to keep the capacity at the same level, or are we just expecting these hardworking people to work even harder?
Madam Chair, Representative, there will be no reduction in FTEs or available technology as a result of the governor's budget. And as Ms. Kelly mentioned, there is additional funding for the laboratory, so we are hoping to continue at the same level and perhaps devote more resources to developing methods and updating our equipment.
Thank you. Representative Spell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the departure of Dr. Osterholm, I am wondering, to go back to your comment about when FTEs are not being filled and that money then is applied to maintain other research. Somebody of his stature, I think, did a wonderful job of communicating to the public concerns, explaining in a very human voice some of these very complex issues. Is there a plan at the Department of Health to find a replacement for Dr. Osterholm? And or is this going to be an unfunded position that will help fund other things at the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, Representative, first I just need to say that there is only one Mike Osterholm. And as much as we would like to replace him, we will never be able to do that. But we currently are looking for a new state epidemiologist. We have posted that position and are doing a national search.
Ms. Senator.
Madam Chair, Ms. Everson, I'm a farmer, and I'm increasingly concerned about pesticides in the environment. And I noticed you didn't talk about that at all. And I know there's some work that goes down in the lab, and I'm not sure if it goes under the Department of Agriculture or you're doing with them. Could you talk a little bit about what you're doing or not doing in terms of monitoring pesticides?
Madam Chair, Representative, our laboratory and the agriculture laboratory both do work with pesticides. Their work is at a higher level of detection. Ours is at a lower level of detection. We tend to analyze drinking water and surface water. I do believe they, speaking for them, I feel a little uncomfortable, but I think they do analyze soil.
Madam Chair, Ms. Everson, how much of this do you do? Do you do it for individuals? Do you just do it for public bodies or public agencies? Are you thinking of expanding that program at all? Any ideas about that?
Madam Chair, Representative, we, again, work in partnership with the programs who operate the drinking water protection program and surface water protection programs. So we work in partnership with them and their program priorities. We don't work with individuals.
Okay.
Am I explaining that?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. So we don't personally, I mean, as a laboratory, have plans to expand that. We would, again, be working with our program partners and with the PTA and with our own environmental health division.
Okay.
Mr. Shumper, your question is good, though, because, I mean, we don't have the historical document here, but there was a time when the public health agency did provide these kind of services to individuals. And maybe you could just go back and check in your records. I remember years ago bringing, you know, some water samples over to be tested there, and the cost was extremely low, whereas nowadays the costs are much, you know, they're higher, and it's all been privatized from what I can tell. So,
yeah. Madam Chair, I think part of the explanation is that at some point in the past, and this was before my time as well, the laboratory at one time had been totally supported with general fund dollars,
mm-hmm.
and so I think it was more able to provide individual or services to individual citizens. And at some point, the funding turned to more of a fee-for-service where, again, working with program partners, they, via a contractual basis, we provide those services to those programs and are reimbursed for those services. And that's how we are primarily funded.
I'm wondering if you would just go back and get me the years on that. I'm aware of that, and I'm would like to, I think it's important for this committee to know what is now can change, what was, did change, and, you know, we can figure out what our public investment should be in some of these areas, and I think there's an interest in this committee for more public access to some of the information about toxic exposures, and so, you know, you may hear from us some more about this, and maybe we can think about some changes. Okay, unless there's any more questions for this division, why don't we go on to the next one? We'll get started with that. I don't know how much we'll get done today, but we'll at least...
Madam Chair, next up is our Office of Emergency Preparedness. And while Aggie Lighthizer comes to the table, I'll just say this activity is primarily funded with federal funds from the Centers for Disease Control. And all of the funding primarily remains within the Department for MDH-based activities. What you see before you on page 11 is just the portion of the one-time funding for PAN flu that remained within the Office of Emergency Preparedness.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I am the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the Minnesota Department of Health, and I will briefly review the activities of the office, and then you have a one-page handout about pandemic influenza funding from last session, and we'll talk through that briefly. Prior to fall of 2001, response to emergencies by the Minnesota Department of Health was really the responsibility of individual programs. Following the attacks of 9/11 and the anthrax events of October 2001, the federal government developed a very federally driven initiative to increase the preparedness of public health and healthcare systems for emergency response. And as a result, the office was created in the spring of 2002. We currently are the coordination entity for the CDC and the HRSA grants. So we have funding for the public health system and funding for the healthcare hospital clinics system of about $24 million for this current year. Over half of that funding goes out in grants to local partners, whether it's local public health, tribal governments, or hospitals. We have six areas of focus in the office, and I'll run through those briefly. The first is a strategic national stockpile, which is a system of rapidly deployed resources from the federal government. And we are asked to rapidly, within 12 hours of our requesting it, be able to bring it to a warehouse, redistribute it, get it out to local communities, and have it available to healthcare systems, to hospitals, to public health clinics for immediate use. One of the special projects of that program is that for the 11 metro counties and two counties in Wisconsin, that we are able to distribute oral medications to every resident in those counties within 48 hours. We don't quite have that in place yet, but we are working with private business and with the postal system, frankly, as one of the ways to distribute that. And we have been doing a variety of exercises to see how close we might be to that, from my perspective, an ambitious goal. Secondly is planning, education, and exercises. We have been doing a lot of work about having plans in place, protocols, job action sheets, a variety of resources to guide our reactions and our response, whether it's to a flood, an ice storm, an infectious disease outbreak, or pandemic influenza. We are required to have staff trained in the National Incident Management System to make sure that we're all using the same approach, the same terms, the same activities. And finally, our plan is only as good as our ability to carry it out, so we have a very ambitious efforts around exercising. This last year, there were about 250 local exercises. Some of you may have been involved in them. There was the largest exercise that we did was in northeast Minnesota. It was run by the local collaborative areas, local public health and hospitals. They distributed, as a practice, 400,000 M&Ms to healthcare responders and the public, and had a very successful practice of that. I don't know what the impact on dental care was after that exercise, but it went very well, and people were very engaged. We have a focus area on administration and legal activities. Some of you have been in the legislature know that we have modernized our emergency response plans and legal authorities, including isolation and quarantine requirements. We have a 24/7 health alert network system that can reach our partners. We also have the ability to do auto phone calls with a computer technology so we can reach our partners very quickly. The fifth area that we work on is healthcare system preparedness, and that's a new area of focus for the department to work with hospitals around emergency response. Hospitals have always had a requirement that they have the ability to respond to an emergency, particularly things like a bus accident or a small event somewhere in their community. We are now starting to work with them on preparing for large events, including pandemic influenza, where as many as a third of Minnesotans may be sick. In 2005, as a result of some of our work, we were prepared at Camp Ripley to receive potentially 3,000 potentially injured, certainly traumatized people from the Hurricane Katrina event. And we were ready within 2 days to accept 3,000 people. Unfortunately, no one chose to come to Camp Ripley. And I'm not sure. There was a great effort by the local school district to develop artwork. And unfortunately, as you walked in the door, the first artwork done in August was a snowman. And I don't know that that had an impact on it, but there was a great amount of effort, and it was a huge success for many of us to learn how quickly we could respond, how engaged the healthcare system was in being prepared to do that, and the local public health response. And our last area that I will talk about is coordination with local public health and tribal government. And there is a saying in emergency management that all disasters are local, and our response does require a very actively engaged, trained, prepared local public health, hospital, and healthcare system. We have been funding local agencies and local tribal governments since the program began in 2002 and has seen a huge amount of interest and involvement and time spent by local government, by hospitals, in being prepared. I know I'm going very fast, and if you have questions or want to go into more detail, I'd be happy to do that. But I want to make sure that we spend just a little bit of time talking about the one-page handout in your packet about pandemic influenza from last session. It was a one-time authorization of $5 million. And we are using the money for various things. First is to purchase a portion of Minnesota's allocated amount of antiviral medications. This is a special contract that the federal government negotiated with the drug companies for a very, very reduced price for antiviral medications that we would stockpile in the event of a pandemic. We are currently in the midst of purchasing those and developing a five-year storage plan. The drugs are good for 5 years. That is not all that we're eligible for. The 67,000 courses, in the governor's budget proposal, he is asking for additional funding to purchase more to be better prepared. We're also purchasing respiratory ventilators, and I use an example of we're buying some bicycles rather than cars as a means of supporting people. Pandemic influenza or influenza as we're seeing it currently in other parts of the world, is a very difficult disease because it affects your respiratory system and many people die of pneumonia. Ventilators who support your breathing are a very important part of the preparedness for that. We do not have enough to support the number of people who would need them, and we're working on building an increased stockpile. And as I said, we're looking at a system that is not the usual system that you would see in an intensive care unit currently in Minnesota, but it would support breathing and it would be an appropriate purchase for our stockpile. Then we're doing additional epidemiology, as you heard about earlier, planning and training and exercises. We are beginning work on a public education campaign, developing themes, materials, resources that we can use to get the word out about public preparedness. That's a theme that we learned from the disasters that have occurred in this country. Individuals being prepared to take care of themselves is one of the foundations of our ability to manage a big event. And then finally, we did an interagency agreement with the Department of Public Safety to do increased support for emergency management, planning activities, business continuity in particular, critical infrastructure activities, and then also for state agencies who are developing continuity of operations plans for their response if a pandemic were to happen. And indeed, we saw 30% to 40% of people not able to come to work. And I'm sure I went really fast. And I will stop now and see if there are questions or if you want to.
Thank you, Ms. Lighthouser. Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Lighthizer, could you go through the numbers? You didn't say them, but the number of people, if it was like the 1918 flu.
Yes.
The number of people in Minnesota that would get sick, the number that would need to be hospitalized, and compare that to the number of hospital beds that you have.
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, yes, the estimates that we use are based on the national estimates, which is that a third of the population would be sick. For Minnesota, that would be 1.5 million people who could be affected and be ill. Of that, about 172,000, in a worst-case scenario, would require hospital-level care. We have currently 16,000 licensed beds in Minnesota. We have a little less right now than 1,000 ventilators, and the estimate is that it would be 26 to, I believe, 5,000 ventilators or more that we would need. The expected number of deaths is around 36,000, which is about what we see annually in this state. So the numbers are tremendous, can get overwhelming. And that's some of our challenge in preparing for an unknown but very devastating event.
Any other questions? Mr. Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But it's my naive understanding that once those patients go to that hospital is now quarantined because of the contagiousness of that disease, and family members can't go visit sick family members for fear of contamination. So, I mean, what do you do with sending those patients to a hospital? Now you've isolated the hospital. It can't take any more patients because of the contagiousness of the...
Ms. Lighthouser?
Madam Chair, Representative, you raised a very good point. Hospitals are required to develop a system of isolation that they can manage a person with an airborne infectious disease. And we've been working with some of the smaller hospitals who didn't have that system in place so that we can manage one or two cases. You're right, though. Once it becomes much more widespread in the community, it would be very difficult to manage that hospital, and it's very likely that we would want to discharge patients with broken legs or other kinds of situations that could be managed elsewhere. So we are trying to contain people, the folks who are infectious, in one place.
Peterson?
But what I have heard, understand, though, that's why it's so vital that we have community-based facilities, i.e. schools, church basements, whatever, that could be the first staging for those people, because once they contact the virus and they go to that facility, high probability they're not leaving. And at that point in time, wouldn't you want to keep your hospitals free from the virus to treat the broken legs and the cancer and et cetera, and isolate these two things going on at some time? And wouldn't we need the community? I mean,
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually are working on plans, just as you talked about. All of the regions are looking at alternate care sites. Where else might we be able to care for patients? How would we set them up? That's part of what the governor's budget proposal is, to develop a stockpile of supplies so that we could use a gymnasium or other places to care for patients. It might not be that we can quite so nicely separate people, and that's one of the questions. Can we rapidly identify? Will there be tests so that we'll know that it's pandemic influenza? Those are some of the questions that we're still working on, but your questions are very good ones that are challenging.
Ms. Lighthizer, you're a nurse yourself, I believe, right? And
yes.
The other issue is the workers, the physicians, the nurses, the other healthcare workers that are going back and forth. What kind of plans that might there be in?
Madam Chair, one of the things that we're very concerned about is supporting healthcare workers coming to work. Personal protective equipment that they feel confident in, that they're trained in, that they can, that we have adequate supplies of. And right now, that again is one of the governor's initiatives around supplies, making sure that we have enough N95 masks. One estimate that we did is that we need 8 million N95 masks to manage the pandemic that we're talking about. They cost about $1 a piece.
Thank you very much. Unless there's any other questions, committee members will conclude today. I want to urge you, if you can, to please leave the governor's budget here, unless you really plan to use it, because we'll be looking at them again when we come back Tuesday. You're welcome to take them, but please be sure to bring them back. Otherwise, just leave them if you don't think they'll do that. Again, those of you who want to go on the tour, and I hope it will be most of you, please contact my office so that we can take care of that. I just realized, I'm not sure that we ever introduced Kate, our other page here, and now she's our permanent page. So, Kate, raise your hand so people get to meet you. Kate's going to be working with us the rest of the session. So, unless any other further questions, the meeting is adjourned.